This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. He was a farmer's son, someone who, by his own description, was not a particularly good Christian in the beginning, but who would spend his adult life bringing others into the fold. Billy Graham's life began in Charlotte on November 7th, 1918. He came to the end of that life yesterday in Montreat at the age of 99.
I've been asked so many times lately, do I fear death? No, I look forward to death with great anticipation. I'm looking forward to seeing God face to face.
That was Reverend Graham in 2005, eagerly anticipating a death that would come 13 years later. And for a man dedicated to spreading the word of God, you could say his was a life well spent. As an adult, his ministry combined that old-time religion with a dash of showmanship and a keen understanding of how media could help him in his quest. His crusades may have started in dusty tents, but eventually he would pack stadiums and TV sets around the world would glow as he preached the gospel.
You that have been watching by television, you can see that many people are coming here in this great carrier dome. What a wonderful sight it is to see men and women of all ages and all backgrounds and all ethnic groups and all colors coming to Christ. And I'm going to ask you to make that commitment where you are now.
He became an influencer in all corners of the globe, heard and followed by millions of ordinary people, but also shaping the thoughts of world leaders and all of the presidents of the United States in the modern era.
Billy Graham, the man, the preacher, the humble farmer's son who helped change the world, is a spiritual gift to all of us.
My testimony today is that I'm just one of tens of millions of people whose spiritual lives have been shaped by Billy Graham.
Every life Billy Graham ever touched, including people who never became president, never spoke at a crusade, is better because he was a good and faithful servant.
A man whose faith had changed the world and that had sustained him through triumphs and tragedies and movements and milestones.
You're in the presence of a great historical figure. He's willing to preach to the most powerful and the least powerful. He has no political agenda. He has an agenda of the Lord.
Presidents George H.W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush. Today we look back on the life of Billy Graham, known as America's pastor and God's ambassador, and we are joined in our Spirit Square studio by Tim Funk, faith and values reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Ken Garfield is communications director for Myers Park United Methodist Church and former religion editor for the Observer. He is also the author of Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures. Good to see you again.
You too.
And Anne Blue Wills is religion professor at Davidson College and co-editor of Billy Graham, American Pilgrim. She's currently working on a biography of Billy Graham's wife, Ruth Bell Graham. Thank you for joining us again. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And with us by phone is Dr. Grant Wacker, professor emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School and the author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Dr. Wacker, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Billy Graham, as we just said, was 99 years old when he died. And in the last decade, he, of course, ceased to be the force that he was during most of the 20th century because he was older and he was ill a lot. But I'm curious what your thoughts were yesterday. What passed through your mind since you've all written about Billy Graham? Some of you know Billy Graham personally or knew Billy Graham personally. What were the first thoughts that went through your mind yesterday when you heard the news? I'll begin with you, Anne.
I thought we have been readying ourselves for his passing, not hoping for it, but knowing that the reality of being 99 mm-hmm. Says certain things about the time one has left. And so I think I just was a little bit surprised. But then almost immediately started anticipating how we would be having a conversation like this, and these conversations would be happening for the next, you know, week or so, trying to assess, trying to grasp the legacy, trying to come to grips with what he has meant.
Same question, Dr. Walker, but I want to add something, because the name of your book is America's Pastor Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. He certainly shaped the nation. Will his influence linger beyond his life?
Oh, I think so. In a way, he represents the closing of an era. He was a product of a time, a particular time, and he helped time, but the time produced him, and that era is gone now. I mean, he rose to prominence in an age that was marked by post-war affluence, fear of communism, the development of radio, a national syndicated phenomenon. So a lot of other reasons why he rose to prominence at the time that he did. He continued to speak to the issues of the age, but those issues have changed. And we would be looking for, I think, new leaders now. So in a sense, it's really true that an era has closed, but man had enormous influence. I don't think with the possible exception of Martin Luther King, I don't think there is any other religious leader who comes close in terms of his influence in shaping how people thought about the Christian faith and the faith's relation to ordinary life.
Today's Charlotte Observer is pretty much the Tim Funk issue.
Billy Graham issue.
Well, I know, but you contributed a great deal to that. So obviously your first thought yesterday was probably, boy, do I have my work cut out for me today.
Well, it's interesting. We have been working on an obituary of Billy Graham. For us, it's a local story. You know,
he's sure.
The most famous charlatan ever. So we've been working on this for 10 years. And so we were ready. But I guess, you know what's interesting? I thought back more than 20 years ago. Ken can talk about this, too. Ken and I were invited to visit with the Grahams around the time he had his last Charlotte Crusade. And I was struck by how, you know, this humility you hear about all the time was just really, you know, impressive and obvious. I mean, he was a bit of a name dropper, but it was funny because all the names were so much less famous than he was that it was kind of funny. He talked about him almost in a childlike wonder, like, oh my gosh, I got to meet Cliff Richard and all these other people. But he also met the Pope and Muhammad Ali, and so I think he was a world figure. But just in his home, he was just a welcoming host. He answered all our questions, and he just was a delight to be around. And he was, you know, elderly at that time too, but he, just to think of this sweep, I mean, he started in the late 40s, you know, as Dr. Walker said, with communism, the atheist to communism, the Cold War, the infant medium of television that he, you know, used to great effect. And he was just this charismatic, dynamic figure. And I think he just rode the wave, and he shaped the wave, I think, over the years.
Ken, as Tim mentioned, you knew him personally. I understand that you considered him to be a personal friend of yours.
Someone I knew and admired, and I think he knew me. And I always tell people that he was warmer and more connecting to people than his PR people would let him be. They kind of, over time, put a wall around him in the media and very carefully managed him.
As often happens to people who are in demand.
Yeah, but in those moments that, like Tim said, the lunch together and some other times, you saw that warmth and that intimacy. I once wrote a column about loneliness, and he wrote me a long letter about loneliness and mentioned my wife. And there were enough personal touches that for me yesterday was kind of a sense of nostalgia.
Sure.
He was 99 and hadn't been well, so there wasn't a deep sorrow in that sense, but there was a real sense of nostalgia.
Well, one of the things that strikes me as not being unusual for somebody who's a true believer, and he was a true believer, is that he did not fear death. And so many people who are true believers, but put that in quotations, do. He embraced the idea of going to see God. Why do you suppose all these people who followed Billy Graham, many of them, would not be so eager for that to happen? I hadn't planned on asking that question.
Yes, it's, you know, the unknown is part of it. And
but you believe. So you know, people should be certain about that.
Well, it's called faith for a reason. I mean, you can't prove anything, but you have strong faith. I think Billy, in his later years, wanted to be with his wife again. I mean, they had a great relationship, and especially in the last years, and I think he talked a lot about that, how lonely he was.
Yeah,
I think the signature Billy Graham story is early in his career, he was challenged for not being more sophisticated in his faith, and he went up to the San Bernardino Mountains in California and prayed and said, I'm going to accept God's word on faith. And I think part of the secret to his success is he had this very simple, understandable faith that touched people who maybe had more fear and uncertainty than he did. And he presented this simple certainty to people that extended to the fact that he was not afraid of death.
And the headline in the Charlotte Observer today is, the secret of my work is God. Let's go back to the beginning. He started in Charlotte.
Might I just say a word before we leave the question of death? The last time I had the great privilege of meeting him four times when he was in his 90s, and my wife was with me each time, and he was far more interested in her than he was in me. He was a Southern gentleman, and he wanted to talk with her about kids and grandkids and Tar Heels and Blue Devils. And, you know, I want to talk with him about, you know, his relationship with Winston Churchill. He wanted to talk about, you know, Tar Heels, but that's very symptomatic of him. I mean, just utterly down home.
Yeah.
But anyway, the last visit, he was in his mid-90s, and he struggled to get up out of the chair to shake hands with my wife. Mm. And he said, I've always been prepared to die. I haven't been prepared to get old.
Mm. Wow.
And I think that was telling of the man. I mean, is this almost mythical figure, and yet he's also so human that we all could relate to that part of it.
He started life in the Charlotte of 1918. It's hard to even fathom what this place was like in 1918. But he was born at home, and the farmhouse was allegedly somewhere near where the Park Road Shopping Center is today, which is right around the corner from all of us here, and into a very different world. Was his family particularly religious?
Yeah. May I say a word, word about just the Park Road? I'm not that familiar. I have not had the privilege of growing up in Charlotte, but his sisters said that they frequently would go an entire day without seeing a single car pass by. So it is an isolated world. It's hard to imagine any place in Charlotte where you go a whole day without seeing a car pass. But that is the isolation, geographic isolation in which he grew up. And I think that makes his career all the more interesting. But especially when you couple it with how he spent the last few years of his life, again, living alone,
right.
With the exception of nurses, he chose to live alone.
Well, I want to zip through his early life when we come back from the break, because he became the foremost Protestant leader of religion and faith in the world, perhaps, not just America. I'm just curious about what the genesis of that was for him, where the seed of that began. And we'll do that when we come back with Tim Funk, Ken Garfield, and Blue Wills, and Dr. Grant Wacker in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about Billy Graham, who died yesterday morning at the age of 99 at his home in Montreat. He's coming home this weekend to be in Charlotte for the remainder of our existence on the planet. Tim Funk is Faith and Values editor for the Charlotte Observer. Ken Garfield, also formerly with the Observer, now communications director of Myers Park United Methodist and author of Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures. And Blue Wills, professor of religion at Davidson College, co-editor of Billy Graham, American Pilgrim. And Dr. Grant Wacker, professor emeritus at the Duke Divinity School and author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Billy Graham His parents, would you describe them as uber religious? I know I read one account where his father said a lot of that Billy had a lot of devilishness in him when he was a young boy.
I think they were religious. They went to the local Presbyterian church, Chalmers ARP, mm-hmm. I think. I think Billy, as a kid, was not particularly. He went to church, but he was more interested in baseball. I think that's what he wanted to do.
You said his first idea of heaven was playing baseball and courting girls.
Apparently, he shook hands with Babe Ruth when he came through Charlotte.
Wanted to be a baseball player.
Yeah. But he wasn't a great natural talent. But then, when he was 16, I believe, he went to a sort of a big tent revival. It wasn't a
Why?
Tent. Actually.
Why did he go? Do you know?
From what I've read, a lot of teenagers were going because they heard that the preacher Mordecai Ham was going to say some things about the local high school, one of the local high schools, and he was kind of a fire-breathing preacher. And it was at Pecan Avenue in Central, around there. And Billy just felt, I think, during one of the hymns, that he felt like he wanted to answer the call. And the rest is history.
I also read that when he answered the call, other people were crying around him, and he did not, and he felt guilty about that.
He didn't have a lot of depth as he remembered that, and, you know, some sunshine or bolt of lightning. He just remembers going up. I recall him saying that he sat behind a woman with a big hat, so he had trouble seeing the stage. Hmm. And it was one of those moments that didn't seem seminal at the time.
Right. He recalled, and I'm not sure where this came from, whether it's the New York Times or the Observer, but he said, "I can't say that I felt anything spectacular.
Right.
I felt very little emotion. I shed no tears. In fact, when I saw others had tears in their eyes, I felt like a hypocrite. And this disturbed me a little. I'm sure I had a tremendous sense of conviction. The Lord did speak to me about certain things in my life. I'm certain of that. But I can't remember what they were." to me is very brave for somebody of his stature to say.
But I've also read that he did see that night as pivotal, and that he went home and talked to his parents and said, "You know, I think I belong to God now." And then his interest started, I think he sold Fuller brushes for a while, but he eventually went into the ministry. I think that's when the genesis you're talking about.
Yeah, people don't remember the Fuller brush salespeople that used to go door to door. I do, because I'm old. But he was evidently a top salesman for Fuller brush.
You would think.
So how about that? I mean, he had that talent early on. Do we know... I know that one evening he witnessed his faith to a group of prisoners at the county jail. That's what the legend has it. Do we know if that was his first attempt at trying to bring
I think it was
souls?
In Union County, wasn't it? I think so.
I think that's right.
It was at a jail in Monroe.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was quite young. he had a great talent for making fun of himself. And he looked back at it, and he said one of his main memories of that evening is the prisoners picking their teeth and looking out the window. he did not think that he had this tremendous impact at the outset. I'd like to go back for just a second, though, to the conversion question.
Sure.
A couple of things there. One is that he often later called it a tearless conversion. And I think that's significant because his crusades were marked by decorum. Some critical observers, usually sociologists, would talk about crowd manipulation. And it's pretty hard to find that. I mean, there are a few moist eyes here and there, but from all firsthand accounts, it was remarkably orderly affair in which people came forward and they made a decision.
Right. Yeah.
It's significant. His magazine's called Decision, his radio program, Hour of Decision.
Right.
And that's it. I mean, you make a decision to shoulder the obligations of being a Christian.
Let's talk about that for a second, Anne. I mean, that's putting the onus on you.
Mm-hmm.
You've made this, you need to make this decision
right.
for yourself.
Right. Right. Well, that's what he held forth as the way to reform an individual, the way to reform society was not to start with a social plan. It was to start with the individual's decision to commit themselves to a Christian life And then, you know, change would flow out from that individual decision. And Grant is right to point to that kind of rational move that one makes. And although the Crusades were carefully planned, carefully orchestrated, the advance was, you know, years, months, and, you know, focused down into a minute-by-minute plan for what was going to happen every night, all to not, gauze someone into something that they didn't realize was happening to them, but to lead them to make that
decision. Take them step by step.
Yeah.
Yeah, lay out the groundwork.
I was always struck by the pluralism of his crusades. Class, color, culture.
Didn't matter.
We've covered a lot of ones that are really a little bit more Pentecostal in nature and a little bit different in that sense. And so you could be a doctor or a warehouse worker and be struck by a Billy Graham crusade.
How do you explain that? The fact that his crusades in the height of the segregated period in this country and the height of the segregated South were integrated. And he made a very strong point of saying, don't let anyone tell you that Jesus is a white man's God. I'm paraphrasing here. He's a white man's God. He's everyone's. Why? How do you explain that in a guy who was born and raised in a rural part of the South?
Actually, Mike, that's an exact quotation.
Is it really?
He said that repeatedly.
Okay.
Yeah. And particularly in Africa, he repeated that over and over. But I'll take a shot at the question, if I may.
Sure.
I think part of the reason that it was so diverse is what Ann said, is that there was meticulous planning. And later on in the Crusades, from it really wasn't until the 80s, but still from the 80s on, they made a point of bringing people of diverse, shall we say, social locations into the planning process. That isn't initially the case, but after a while, they learned how important that is, that from the ground up, we have to have African-American, Hispanic-American pastors be involved. The Crusades became more integrated from that point on, because then the pastors went home and they pressed for participation. I mean, that really counted. But there's the other side to it, and that is his crusades are not integrated until 1953. Mm-hmm. It was like Billy Sunday before him. They were separated. Sometimes he spoke to black-only audiences and white-only, white-only audiences. More often, audiences that were separated with seating, with whites in front and blacks in the back. And sometimes there were rope. Sometimes they were self-segregated, but in any case, the races were separated.
But that evolved over time. But the one thing that there seems to be some question about, and it was, I think, in one of your articles in the paper this morning, Tim, was that he did not participate in the civil rights marches of Dr. King. He didn't participate in the March on Washington, and he, I think, is alleged to have said you explain it. You wrote the article.
Well, you know, in the 1950s, he befriended Martin Luther King. He called him Mike, I think, because he was, you know, pretty good friends, and he promoted him. I think King spoke at the 1957 New York Crusade. But in the 60s, the civil rights movement started becoming more sort of controversial or confrontational, I should say, with marches, people getting arrested. And William Martin, who's written the book, a biography of Billy Graham, says that Billy just didn't like that kind of confrontation and going to jail, and he sort of kept his distance. Now, Billy always said, well, Martin said I should stay in the stadiums and he'd take care of the protests. But I think there are a lot of civil rights leaders like John Lewis, who I talked to when he was in Rock Hill, and Jesse Jackson, who think something was lost, a great chance of Billy connecting with Martin Luther King, going March on Washington to bring the white and black Christians together in a bigger way.
Dr. Wills.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this since yesterday morning with more kind of focus, but thinking about people who do criticize Graham and who do look on him as a problematic figure, a more problematic figure, because of his stance on civil rights. And I just thinking about the way that Southern white Protestantism in particular tends to or has tended to shy away from social engagement. And I think his reluctance or his, parceling out of the landscape, so you take I'll take the stadiums and you take the streets, has allowed the white Protestant habit of letting the individual be responsible for social change rather than moving that individual out into community with other people and demonstrating and marching. I think if there are problems with Graham's legacy, I think that's one thing that has come from the work that he did, that a lot of Southern white Protestants have felt okay with leaving it to the individual, I'm not a racist, to be okay with kind of leaving it there.
Ken.
Everybody's legacy is complicated. It's not black and white. Right. And I think in addition to the civil rights, it's the partisanship and the getting too close to presidents and the kind of having a sense of, oh, he's a sycophant mm-hmm. to people. And I noticed the coverage last night on the CBS Evening News, this was the third story, wasn't the first story.
Right.
And I think
But they did it twice. They closed the broadcast.
Correct.
With the long piece.
Correct.
Well.
But, you know, so I think outside the his hometown and his neighbors, I think that's part of the legacy as well, the partisanship and being the celebrity preacher. And so everybody's legacy is complicated, much less a guy who spent 50 years in the spotlight.
And by the 1960s, I think Billy Graham was really part of the establishment. He was close to presidents Johnson and Nixon, and he wanted to work the inside channels. He felt at home in the White House. So he was kind of cut off from what was going on in the streets and grassroots, and he just didn't believe that was the way to affect change.
And let's go back to those early tent meetings, because tent meetings, at least I think the South, or at least as portrayed in movies and television, of the 30s and 40s and 20s and even before that, were usually fire and brimstone affairs. Where you were scared to death not to come forward and respond to the altar call. He didn't approach it that way. He had a very strong, rapid, dynamic speaking style. But then again, he kind of coaxed people to come forward. Here's how it sounded in 1958.
Don't neglect it. Don't put it off till another night. You may never have another moment quite like this tonight. I'm going to ask all of you in this building to get up out of your seat right now. Hundreds of you. Just get up now and come and stand right here in front. And say tonight, I want Christ. I will identify myself with him at the cross. I'm ready to turn from my sins. I'm ready to give myself to Christ. I want him to fill my life. I want him to help solve my problems and forgive my sins and lift my burdens.
He was a strikingly handsome man. That certainly must have helped him both in these tent meetings and later on when he came to television in its infancy. He had the kind of features that cameras love.
Correct.
What role did that play in elevating him?
Oh, I think a lot. He had this celebrity look, this celebrity feel. He was an electric speaker. When you see him in later years and he has slowed down, I think that frailty, in a sense, spoke as well to touching people in a different sort of way. So I think as his message kind of broadened and his evangelism broadened, that frailty kind of played into that.
He brought Protestantism out of the wilderness. That's what I read yesterday. I did not understand this quite frankly, but maybe somebody can expand on this. It is said that he was able to help evangelical Protestants regain the social influence that they once had, reversing a retreat from public life that had begun when their efforts to challenge evolution theory were defeated in the Scopes trial of 1925. I guess Protestants retreated into the background and shut up. He brought them back out. Is that true?
May I say a word about looks and then how that related to his ability to bring Protestants into the public. I once made a point to look at newspaper coverage in his Los Angeles revival in 1949, and of the many articles that I just sampled, there were far more. Every single one of them commented on his appearance, and many of them commented in the very first paragraph In fact, we will see an obituary in Newsweek that I have seen already, and the very first line of it, his face was Hollywood handsome. And I think he wouldn't often get that today, but that's how it was then. And he fit the stereotype of the Nordic handsome white male, 6 feet to 180 pounds, and he made a point.
He was, and he came, and he like came al- he came along as television made its debut,
yeah,
and made its inroads into America and became almost the national pastime at night for almost everybody in America. They'd sit, yeah, behind the television or in front of the TV set. The meeting of those two forces, yeah, must have been, yeah, serendipitous.
So it's a modern media.
Well, actually,
okay, go ahead, Grant.
One person who was there saw him early on in television, and she said his azure blue eyes came across when color television became popular. And you just think, and we don't often relate evangelistic success to, right, azure blue eyes. But the key point is that one of his associates was asked about the relation between his appearance and his success. And the associate supposedly just smiled and said, well, obviously the Lord doesn't make people handsome to make them good evangelists. But then he smiled and he said, but it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Cecil B. DeMille apparently offered, yeah, him the role of Samson in a Hollywood movie. And his wife reminded him he wasn't an actor, he was an evangelist. And she came up, I believe, with the title of his TV show, Hour,
right,
of Decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was a pretty – you could talk about that, Ann. I mean, her –
But not now you can't. We have to stop. And when we come back, if you'd like to expand on that, you can. And we will also talk about his relationship with various presidents down through the 20th century. We're talking about Billy Graham, who died yesterday at 99 on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Funk is here from the Charlotte Observer. Ken Garfield from Myers Park United Methodist. Ann Boo Wills, a religion professor at Davidson College. And Dr. Grant Wacker from Duke Divinity School, all of whom have written books about Billy Graham. You wanted to go back, Ann, and talk about, except for you, Tim. I'm sure your book is
coming. Well, some people think my stories are so long.
That's
that
right. Today is the beginning of your book in the Observer. We wanted to go back and talk more about Billy Graham, the event. Evangelist.
Right. And just thinking about how he did use technology, use television, use film, use music, used his good looks to bring, you were talking about evangelicals out of the wilderness after the Scopes trial and the kind of public shaming that, even though that case was won, that there was a kind of retreat from the public eye. And I think all of these things that Graham and his team, all of those methods they were able to deploy in the Crusades and in his public image, creating that image, helped to make evangelicalism cool again.
Talk about his message, because evangelists that we remember most always have a central message. God wants to take your suffering. God wants you to be successful. He wants you to be rich. He wants you to be happy. Mm. What was his message?
Yeah, we'll strike off a couple of those for him.
My favorite moment of covering Graham was during the altar calls when this mass choir would sing Just As I Am and you'd be in some big stadium.
Which we will hear later in this program.
Great. Okay. And people would come down and he'd say, you in the farthest reaches, come down, we'll wait for you. And to me, that was it was the ministry of second chances. It was the sense of hope that he gave a lot of people. A lot of people came to the Crusades, were Christians, and were living wonderful, decent Christian lives, but there are a lot who didn't and weren't.
He partnered old-time religion with modern media. His message was same as Paul's, give your life to Christ.
Right.
And he never wavered from that, but he wrapped it in modern...
Which a lot of mainline Protestant theologians and leaders evidently found simplistic, at least initially. Did that criticism quiet down as he gained stature?
No, I mean that San Bernardino Mountain story. I'm gonna just live by faith and preach a simple message, which he would admit he preached a simple message. Mm-hmm. And so it was the delivery and the sense of assurance that he gave people, blessed assurance. That's what stays with me.
Harry Truman was the first president that he met. Tim, would you say that he influenced Harry Truman in any way, or is the reverse true?
No. The people who went with him dressed in white with white buck shoes, which they thought was a sort of a tribute to Truman's choice of garb. And the mistake he made is after he met with Truman, he went on the White House lawn and he told reporters everything that had happened in the meeting,
which is a
violation of protocol, mm-hmm. you know. And so Truman said, "Oh, this guy just wants his name in the papers." It was not an auspicious beginning. But after that,
Truman never forgave him. Actually,
Truman said he claims he's a friend of all presidents, but he was never a friend of mine. All he's interested in is getting his name in the papers. Wow.
Ouch. Yeah, you ask if Truman, Graham influenced Truman. I think it was certainly the reverse, and that Graham influenced Truman in the sense that he raised Truman's antagonism toward Graham in particular, and you know, probably evangelist preachers in general.
President Eisenhower is said to have used Graham as a sounding board on racial questions. Is that because he kept his crusades open and integrated, or was there some other? Because I know he told Eisenhower to send in the troops to Little Rock, to the Central High School there, when white students were trying to prevent black students from going.
Well, that's a fine point, is that Eisenhower had already decided to do that.
Okay.
And he was calling Graham. I don't think he was calling for Graham's advice. What he wanted was legitimation or confirmation. He'd already decided. He'd already talked with Nixon, and he'd made all the preparations to send the troops in. But he's just checking in with Graham. Of course, Eisenhower didn't put it this way, but, you know, what would a man of the cloth think about this? I don't think preachers usually have much influence on presidents. They think they do, but
well, he later told President Eisenhower that he would be getting into heaven when.
I think a lot of these presidents, a lot of these presidents saw how popular Billy Graham was, and they kind of wanted to hug him and get some of that charisma to rub off on them. In fact, Chuck Colson, a Nixon aide, said that specifically. We wanted Billy around because he was popular, and we needed some of that popularity.
There are several stories about John F. Kennedy and Billy Graham. One is, and I don't know either of these stories are necessarily true, one is that Billy Graham tried to organize other evangelical preachers in opposition to the election of John Kennedy because he was Catholic. Later on, Billy Graham would be going to the White House during the Kennedy administration and told reporters that Kennedy's election had promoted better relations between Catholics and Protestant churches. Are both those stories true?
Yes, both stories are true, ironically. This is a testament to the kind of man Graham was. He changed his mind and the face of evidence. I mean, he did participate in a meeting in Switzerland and then in Washington, D.C., just before the election to try to stop Kennedy. And Graham always had good relations with Catholics. He had no problems with Catholicism, became friends, actually, with the Pope. But he did have, like most evangelicals, actually probably the majority of Americans, he had great fear of a Catholic in the White House, because if there's a conflict between American policy and Vatican policy, well, who's going to win? And so he was afraid of a Catholic in the White House, and he did, behind the scenes, work for Nixon's election, and stressed behind the scenes. I mean, he did it subterraneanly, and I think it's one of the few actually marks of just outright duplicity on Graham's part. It's a dark mark on his record.
He let Norman Vincent Peale take the public face on it. So
LBJ evidently asked Billy Graham not only for spiritual advice but secular advice, much to the chagrin of Ruth Bell Graham, who was alleged to have kicked Billy Graham under the table at the White House when he was offering advice, and allegedly Billy Graham chose Hubert Humphrey to be LBJ's running mate because he was asked, who would you choose? And he said, Hubert Humphrey. Is that true? Anybody know?
I think that's true. But he also tried to persuade Nixon to make Mark Hatfield his vice presidential nominee and choice over Spiro Agnew. And we can only imagine how
that would have been a better choice.
most of us would say, yeah. But, you know, we always think of Graham as a political conservative, and yet Hatfield was probably the most, quote, liberal Republican at the time, if not ever. I think this is this shows Graham's strong feeling that personal character matters.
Yeah, he got along with Democrats and Republicans, and he was accused of being dragged into politics from time
and
to time.
He was a registered Democrat.
But not from the pulpit.
If I get up and talk about some political issue, it divides the audience. And what I want is a united audience to hear only the gospel.
You were saying, Tim, that he was a registered Democrat?
Yeah, all his life. And given
his
the...
Life. Still is.
Still
yesterday.
Is. Well, till yesterday. Mm-hmm. But I think, compare what he just said to Franklin Graham, who's now sort of a general in the culture wars and is sort of preaching to the choir.
Explain that.
Well, I think the society has changed, and we're in these camps, political camps, and I think Franklin perceives his role differently than Billy. Billy, I think, was an evangelist who wanted to reach out to a broad audience, and I think Franklin has become convinced that he has a mission. And I think his mother thought this, that the culture is going awry and he needs to try to lead the troops to elect the right people and, you know, put a justice on the Supreme Court who is against abortion. And and he does it in a fairly blunt style that I think was not his father's style.
It was his relationship with Richard Nixon that would damage Billy Graham's reputation, at least for a while, refusing to believe initially that the president was involved in Watergate until it was too late. And then when the White House tapes were released, he was caught on those tapes in conversation with Richard Nixon. The two were heard agreeing that liberal Jews controlled the media and were responsible for pornography. Graham was heard saying, quote, "A lot of the Jews are great friends of mine. They swarm around me and are friendly to me because they know that I'm friendly with Israel, but they don't know how I really feel about what they are doing to this country." What effect did that have when that came out? He later admitted, and he said he didn't remember the comment, but it was on tape, so he couldn't deny it, and he apologized for it. What impact did that have?
Oh, yeah,
I think it's important to say, look, I'm sorry, Tim. Is this Tim?
Yeah, this is Ken.
Go ahead. Yeah.
You know, he was, I think, legitimately grieved about that, and I think that's part of the journey that he took to a more expansive, broader ministry. You know, he admitted his frailty. He grieved about that, and I think that's part of the journey that he took. That now Franklin is kind of back, you know, going in a different direction, made a U-turn. And I think it's a fascinating part of the story is that Billy moved away from that, and as Tim and Ann know, he's now in the midst of it.
It's understandable his influence over American presidents because he was an American. How do you explain his ability to penetrate the Iron Curtain and be welcomed in to lead his crusades behind the Iron Curtain at a time when religion was prohibited in those countries? What was it about Billy Graham?
Before we go into that, it's an important question. I would like to add one thing to Ken's comment about his relationship with Jews. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of anti-Semitism anywhere except for that incident. But what I think is very telling about it is that after it was revealed in 2002, Graham made a trip to Cincinnati to Hebrew Union University to speak to the rabbis face-to-face. And as the story goes, one of his associates there and told me the story is that he came into a room with rabbis and they actually stood when he came into the room and he asked him to sit. He said, "I'm the one who should be on my knees." And he said, "I've come to tell you the things I said that day were unforgivable, but I'm begging you to forgive me." And by all evidence, they did. That says as much about the graciousness of the Jews that were there that day, the rabbis were there. But also, it says a lot about Graham's ability to repent and to recognize his own mistake. And I think that went long way.
Very quickly, how do you explain his international influence, particularly in areas of the world that prohibited the practice of religion?
Just to pop in, Ruth didn't want him to go behind the Iron Curtain, and I think that says something about her, her caution about him becoming involved in geopolitics, and also her belief in Christian anti-communism. But Grant probably has more ideas about why he felt moved to go there.
I think it's complicated. One, it took years of negotiation. It didn't happen overnight. So it was very difficult. He had wanted to do this for years. And just at the very human level, it was a kind of a sense of adventure. No other American evangelist had ever done that. And I think, you know, he never admitted it, never put it this way, but I mean, just as a human, he certainly wanted to.
Grant, you called him America's pastor, and in many ways he was. Yeah. On many notable occasions, yeah. Yeah. He was the person called on to salve the nation's wounds, and we have two examples of that. First, his remarks following Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, in which many children died, and then his remarks surrounding the 9/11 memorial.
I have been asked the question several times, many times, why does God allow it? Why does a God of love and mercy that we read about and hear about allow such a terrible thing to happen? I don't know. There's something about evil we will never fully understand this side of eternity. Times like this will do one of two things. It will either make us hard and bitter and angry at God, or they will make us tender and open and help us to reach out in trust and faith. I pray that you will not let bitterness and poison creep into your soul, but that you will turn in faith and trust in God, even if we cannot understand. We all watched in horror as planes crashed into the steel and glass of the World Trade Center. Yet underneath the debris is a foundation that was not destroyed. Therein lies the truth of that old hymn, "How firm a foundation." Yes, our nation has been attacked, buildings destroyed, lives lost. But now we have a choice, whether to implode and disintegrate emotionally and spiritually as a people and a nation, or whether we choose to become stronger through all of this struggle to rebuild on a solid foundation.
I have 30 seconds left. A listener wants to know, how do you explain his legacy to a younger generation, especially one that is largely moving away from organized religion?
I'll just say, when my students who don't know who Billy Graham is or was ask who was he, why does he matter, I try to show them, tell them how he helped create the world that we live in now, religiously, socially, how religion relates to culture. That's important.
Anne Blue Wills is professor of religion at Davidson College, co-editor of Billy Graham, American Pilgrim. Dr. Grant Wacker from Duke Divinity School, America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Ken Garfield from Myers Park United Methodist, Billy Graham, A Life and Picture, and Tim Funk from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all.